Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, again. I'd like to introduce you to Mr. Jimmy Webb. Appreciate that so much.
Thank you.
I'm alive again. I'm really happy to be in Manchester, and I know I'm saying Manchester. I was a highwayman.
Here we go.
will all be back again.
I haven't been to England in, well, 3 years or so. Anyway, the last time I was here, I toured with the flu. That was my supporting act. That was something I really wouldn't like to do again. The show must go on, as you know. That record was recorded by Waylon Jennings, Chris Christopherson, Johnny Cash, and Willie Nelson. And there have been some other people, but by far that's the most successful. And you're saying, oh, you mean all at the same time, for God's sake? Oh, yeah, all at the same time. Four lads, they each had a verse, which worked out very nicely for me. As I had never been to Farm Aid before, I'd always wanted to go to Farm Aid. Never really received my invitation kept getting lost in the mail. And then all of a sudden, somebody called from Farm Aid and said, do you want to go to Farm Aid? And I said, oh man, I'd love to go to Farm Aid. My family are farmers, like, goes back 1,000 years. And they said, all right. And they sent me tickets, and they sent me backstage passes. They didn't ask me to play, but I didn't care. I was backstage bobbing around Irving, Texas, 65,000 people crammed into this football stadium for Willie's picnic. And I'm walking around, I'm looking at Bruce Hornsby, and I'm just going gaga. I get starstruck with the best of them. I just met Robert Plant backstage, and that just about, you know, had to get out the old fibrillator. Goodness, I was excited. And I'm walking along backstage, and all of a sudden I come face to face with Willie Nelson. Well, you know, it was like an apparition, ladies and gentlemen. It was like he was in a cloud of smoke, you know? And he had a red bandana. And he had those pigtails, and he just appeared in front of me. And he said, hello, Jimmy. He said, I didn't know you were here. And I said, I didn't know I was here. It's you. And he said, yeah. And I said, wow. He said, you know what? We were thinking we'd do your song today. And I said, oh, really? Could you? You know, you think? And he said, well, I don't know. He said, because Johnny Cash is sick. And I said, oh, that's too bad. And he said, but we could do it, you know. And I said, great, I can't. He said, but you'd have to sing Johnny Cash's part. And I said, oh, that's bad. I said, yeah, because, you know, I'm only licensed to play for 300 people. 65,000 people. They could jerk my license, you know. He said, well, hell, Jimmy. He said, you're wearing black. He said, just go out there and they'll think you're Johnny Cash. I don't think they thought that at all. I did it, though. I was looking at some of those big TV screens, you know, those Madison Square Garden type of things. And they tell you things about your face that you thought were well-kept secrets. But for a little while that afternoon, Galveston, oh, Galveston. I still hear your sweet bells rolling. I still see her dark eyes glowing. She was 21 when I left Galveston. Galveston, oh Galveston, I still hear your sea waves crashing. But I watch the cannon flashing, and I clean my gun, I dream of Galveston. It was called a police action for a while, and then it was You know what they decided to call it? The Vietnamese conflict. And never called it a war. Never called it a war. And there's 58,000 names on that wall in Washington, D.C. I wrote that song for those guys. You know, I never really thought that I was a country songwriter. I had some success in that realm. I was born and raised on a farm. And my father was a Baptist minister. Did a lot of manual labor when I was growing up. I feel like I'm, you know, I'm working class. I hope I am, because otherwise I don't know what the hell I was working so hard for. I remember when we moved up to the Panhandle of Oklahoma, and I used to drive a great big International Harvester tractor with an umbrella on it, and I had my transistor radio dangling from my umbrella. Now, there may be those of you out there who don't even know what the hell I'm talking about. The transistor radio was to the 50s and 60s what the cell phone is to the 21st century. And it was a pretty remarkable instrument because for the first time, a man could like carry the whole top 40 around, you know, in his shirt pocket. I had a little green one. I listened to that thing all the time. It drove my dad crazy. Because my dad really wanted me to, you know, I think go to Africa and be a missionary or something. My mother, on the other hand, just wanted me to play piano for the First Baptist Church. And she and I had an agreement that if I played the piano for an hour every day, she wouldn't hit me with a stick. Middle of the pasture, and I turn my tractor around, I'm coming back down, I'm turning that wheat over, boy, getting ready to plant a new crop. And a song comes on there. There is someone watching your footsteps. Turn around, look at me. Did you ever hear that? There is someone walking behind you. Turn around. Look at me. Oh, I'm waiting, but I'll wait forever. Oh, you. I can't get up any higher than that. That's why I only have a permit for 300 people. Glenn Campbell, on the other hand, he could get right up on there. He could go from about here to there in a seamless voice. His voice never broke. He never went from a chest voice to a head voice. It was just this glistening, you know, kind of rod, you know, this magical instrument. And it was him singing. I was 14 years old, and I'm crazy for that record. I went home, my dad was sitting in his study, and I went in with a great deal of trepidation, because among other things, kind of ticks that my father had picked up during the Second World War. He was in the South Pacific for 37 months, and he came back a little jumpy. He used to keep a K-bar taped to the steering column in our old 48 Mercury, and you wanted to be pretty careful when you approached that car. He could always tell you what you were going to say before you finished saying it. He was like clairvoyant like that. I went into the office, just laboring over a sermon, and I said, Dad, I just heard a song. I said, yeah, Daddy, I just heard a song on the radio. Weird shit. And I said, Dad, And I was just wondering if I could please just borrow a dollar and the car. And that's what I wanted. I drove 22 miles to Beaver, Oklahoma. I bought Turn Around, Look at Me by Glen Campbell. Bought it back home, 14 years old, and wore it out. When I got finished with that 45, it was about the same texture as the top of this piano here. And I would get down and beside my bed and I'd pray and I'd say, "Dear God, one of these days, please help me to write a song just half as good as Turn Around, Look at Me. And if it wouldn't be too much trouble, if you could work it in, I'd like to meet somebody like Glen Campbell to sing my song." And I should have said, "And I want to be a big rock and roll star and have a Cadillac." I was on a roll there. I was working for Johnny Rivers Music, Soul City Records, and hanging around Hollywood. Had a couple of Everly Brothers cuts. And I didn't worship them. And I had a cut on a Supremes Christmas album. I thought I was doing pretty damn good. One day I was driving my car down the Santa Ana Freeway, and I heard a song of mine that I'd written over at Motown because I was a staff writer there. I wrote 45 songs at Motown. And they're still there. No one has ever disturbed them as far as I know. I'm aware of, but it was a song called "By the Time I Get to Phoenix." And I remember that when I quit over at Motown and said, "You guys aren't doing anything with my songs," I quit, and they said, "Okay, fine, take 'By the Time I Get to Phoenix' with you." It's true. It's true. Take 'By the Time I Get to Phoenix' and up and away. Take those away. And they gave me about half a dozen songs and sent me packing. So I'm driving down the Santa Ana Freeway one day, and Glen Campbell comes on the radio, and he sings this.
Just
won't say I was a little bit surprised to hear Glenn's voice singing one of my songs, because after all, I asked God to do that for me. But actually, there was almost a serious traffic accident. There was several swerving cars and some shrieking brakes there, because I pulled over to the side in my old Volkswagen. Every hippie in L.A. had a Volkswagen. Had to have one of those. I'd been to the Monterey Pop Festival, and that was the first big music festival. And I was, I played the piano with Larry Nechtel, Joe Osborne, Hal Bling, the Wrecking Crew. There's a great documentary about the Wrecking Crew now that you can see on Amazon for the first time. It's got over 40 hit records, hit songs, as part of the soundtrack. I remember when Hal Blaine played on, these were Grammy Awards. He played on 7 records of the year in a row, a drummer. Larry Nechtel sort of taught me to play the piano in the studio. It was a whole different ball of wax, you know. It was then the First Baptist Church, I mean. It was an interesting time in music. There were epic albums coming out, like Pet Sounds, Sgt. Pepper. I remember one night that Johnny Rivers and I took acid and listened to Sgt. Pepper in front of his fireplace. And sounded pretty good, actually. The cops, though, I got to tell you, I've never told this story before. Right in the middle of Sgt. Pepper, and we're on acid, and in the middle of Sgt. Pepper, a whole bunch of police sirens go off, and all these lights start, like, you know, blinking red, blue, and all this, and there's a hubbub, and there's guys shouting outside, and all that. And Johnny Rivers said, "We're busted, we're busted." And he said, "Here, take it to the bathroom." And I headed for the bathroom, you know, to flush the load down. And as soon as I got to the bathroom, I looked out, and I could see that there was a fire engine next door. The house next door was on fire. You know, what can I say? I'm sure somehow or other we caused the fire, but I don't. Anyway, I was writing things. I was working with a group called The Fifth Dimension, which I know weren't real popular over here. We were trying to do our Sgt. Pepper, you know. And there were albums. Bob Dylan was coming out with epic albums. And I have to tell you the truth. I always loved Bob Dylan. I still do. But I always had to get the lyric sheet out to understand what was written. I mean, I just say that with all the kindness in the world, but I just had to get the lyric sheet out. What the hell is he singing about? And then, you know, the Rolling Stone would say, "Well, this is an epic, you know, sociological statement, you know, from a master, a craftsman, and an epic milestone in folk rock history." I go, "Is it that good?" You know, I'm not bitter. You know, then Leonard Cohen would come out with an album, and it would be a song like Suzanne, which is, "Suzanne takes you down to the boat by the river. Then it goes up one more note. Stays there for a little while. Come back down to the snow. Now it's up here on the Albany Ford, getting real adventurous. We're running back down to the first snow." You know, but not bitter. Not. And I wrote this song for these wonderful kids, The Fifth Dimension. And I wrote a song for them about. I thought that my I was probing. I was reaching for serious shit. You know, I wrote a song. Well, you know, I have to admit, it was about balloons. Go on, laugh. And it was a hit. You know what? I think it was a hit in England, too. After some research, I discovered that it wasn't actually a hit record. It was a bread commercial. It was a Nimble bread. This other commercial where the girl, she flies like a bird, right? But I think that there were two of them. I'm not sure. I'm really. I think Johnny Mandel. He raced us up the charts in the United States. Johnny Mandel had a record identical to our record of Up, Up, and Away. So when we were 60 on the chart, he was 61. And when we were 30, he was 29. And it was the same freaking record, you know? I mean, what the hell are we talking about here, you know? So I always thought, because I think we finally made it to like 8. And I thought, without him, it would have been a number one record. Record business is full of sob stories, you know. I remember one day my manager called me and he said, "Jimmy, I've got some sadness, you know, some troubling news." I said, "You must have the wrong Jimmy Webb." He said, "Well, we've got a problem." I said, "I don't have problems. I drive my Camaro. I date beautiful chicks. And I write songs. No problems." He said, "We're in deep shit." I said, "What? What could it possibly be?" And he said, "Well, you know, KOMA, stay, you know, in Oklahoma City. KOMA, Oklahoma City, 50,000 watt, you know, radio station. Top 40 radio station. We loved that station in the 60s and 70s because when there was a real top 40, they played the 40 top records. Today, you have a different situation. But it was crystal clear, you know. All the hit records were on this list. And they had to be on a certain list of stations. And then when all that added up, you had a hit. It was that simple. And he said, "Yesterday afternoon about 3 o'clock, KOMA took your record off the air." And I said, "You're kidding me." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, they made an announcement they're no longer going to play Up, Up, and Away." I said, "You're kidding me? What are you talking about?" I said, "What for? What on earth for?" He said, "Well, Jimmy," he said, "look, I don't know how to, I'll just give it to you straight." He said, "They think it's about drugs." Now here's the ironic thing. Of all 40 songs that were on the chart that week, the only one that wasn't about drugs was Up, Up, and Away. And I got to feeling kind of down about this. And I called my dad back in Oklahoma City, where he was pastoring a church. And I said, "Dad," I said, I've got a problem. And I said, "I guess it's going to be on TV, and there's going to be a big deal. And I don't want you to hear about this." I said, "Dad, you know, it looks like they're going to take my record off the radio." I said, "Yeah, I don't know how you know that, but..." "Dad," I said, I didn't want you to hear it from anybody else." I said, "You know, the worst part of it is, Dad, you know, it's bad." I said, "You know, the worst part of it is they think it's about drugs." And I said, "Yeah." And I guess I kind of, you know, cheered up a little bit. I mean, I was like 19 years old. You know, my heart was kind of broken because this is my hometown and my peeps, you know, kind of stabbed me in the back a little bit. He said, "Well, we'll see about that." Slams down the phone. Got his 45 out of the closet. And with his Bible in one hand and his 45 in the other hand, he got in his old Ford pickup and drove down to KOMA. In old days, radio stations were just houses with letters painted on them. They didn't have metal detectors. They didn't have guards. They didn't have shit. They just had a bunch of guys in there playing records, you know? You could walk in there anytime you wanted. I walked into 1,000 radio stations, believe it or not. Sometimes I walk in and say, hey, would you guys play this record? I'll be damned on the way home. Play that record. Man, that was a record business you could love. You could love it because it was real. It was all around you. And my dad walked into that radio station and asked for some quality time with the program director. Went into the conference room, and as legend has it, there was some probably praying going on. Somebody said, oh Jesus. Somebody said, dear God, you know. Pretty religious, I guess. 5 or 10 minutes later. Yes, you can applaud for my dad. That's the kind of old man you gotta have. And that was in 1966. In the spring of 1967, we had the 14th Grammy Awards. And we had them out in the San Fernando Valley, in the Sportsman's Lodge. And there's more people in here right now than there were at the 14th Grammy Awards ceremony. We were sitting at tables, but it was about the same number. And that night, Up, Up, and Away won a Grammy for Song of the Year, 1967. Fifth Dimension won a Grammy for Album of the Year for Up, Up, and Away. They won a Grammy for Best New Group. Wayne Kimball, who designed our album cover, he won a Grammy for Best Album Cover. And somewhere over there on the backstretch was Glenn Campbell. He won a Grammy for Best Male Vocal Performance for By the Time I Get to Phoenix. So it was a night of complete and utter victory. It was delirium. It was just crazy. It's like, you know, you talk about once in a lifetime thing. That was insane. And it wouldn't have happened except for my dad. And my dad is, I want you to know, well, he's good. He's 94 years old. He reads his Bible every day. Sings a lot better than I do. So I was kind of, you know, doing well. It sounds like I was doing pretty good, right? And I had considered to play some background music for an anti-war pageant that was taking place at the old Cornet Theater on La Cienega Boulevard in L.A. And it was a kind of a free-for-all with like 50 of the greatest stars in Hollywood. I mean, guys like Edward G. Robinson, Jimmy Cagney, Walter Pigeon, Lucille Ball, Maureen O'Hara. I mean, I'll tell you this, Charlton Heston was not there. There were a goodly few, you know, of people who were, you know, getting a little tired of the Asian conflict or whatever they wanted to call it. And the guy who was directing the program was this mad, but, you know, beautifully mad, Irish actor named Richard Harris. And Richard Harris would have me improvise to various scenes that were played out, and sometimes poetry, readings, little scenes. And he taught me lots and lots of Irish songs, probably 40 or 50. Like Carrick Fergus, I can remember, was part of the program. Thank you. go out after the performance. Richard would say, "Ah, oh, Jimmy Webb. He always called me Jimmy Webb. Never Jimmy and never Webb, but always Jimmy Webb." And he'd say, "Ah, oh, Jimmy Webb, let's go out and have a black velvet and a Jameson's back." I've never been drinking in my life, because I'm drunk today, and I'm seldom sober. Boston Rover, from town to town. Ah, but I'm sick now, sure my days are numbered. All ye fair young maids, won't you lay me down? It's always something like that, you know, like dying, you know. And I tell you flat out, I fell in love with the guy, and I fell in love with the culture, I fell in love with the music. It reminded me a lot of some of the Baptist hymns I had learned to play. Simple songs like Amazing Grace and other hymn book things. And he and I, you know, one night were feeling pretty good, I guess, after a few black velvets. If I hadn't been sober for the last 15 years, by God, I'd order me a black velvet right now. But I've got some sort of a record to maintain here, so. But if I was going to do it, it would be right here in Manchester tonight. And that's the truth. And those of you who know me know that's the truth. So one night we get all cozy in the pub and we're drinking. And Richard says, I said to Richard, "You know, Rich, I like your voice. You know, he'd just done Camelot." I said, "We need to do a record. We should do a record." And he said, "Ah, oh, Jimmy Webb," he said, "you're right." He said, "I've always wanted to make a record." He said, "I'll be talking to you about that." So, play ends, everybody goes home, satisfied that we've done our bit against the war. And two or three weeks later, I get a telegram from London that says, "Dear Jimmy Webb, come to London, make record. Love, Richard." And the air tickets are in there. The whole thing is, I didn't even remember what I said. I say that to everybody. I said it to a cab driver once in New York. I think it was the worst night of his life. He parked his cab in front of the Hit Factory, and I dragged him in and made him sing. Well, I've never been anywhere before. I'm an Oklahoma boy. And back in those days, we flew 707s. Can you believe that? That there was ever even a plane called a 707? Pretty nice planes. We had a nice airline called Pan Am. Yeah. Flew to London on Pan Am. And absolutely lost my mind at the beauty, you know, of something that really had history, that really had some sense of permanence and legacy to it. I think that most Americans do fall in love a little bit when they come to England and they see the beautiful structures that you have. Realize that this city right here was founded in 79 A.D. Mancusians. Am I right? So I was pretty overcome by that. I loved the women. The first three English girls I met, I fell in love with. I'm sorry, guys, but I couldn't help myself. I hopelessly, like, actually, it was the third one.
I was on my third girlfriend, and I realized, hey, they all talk like that. It was too late, because she was Miss World. And it's like Harry Nielsen said to me one time, he said, I could never accuse you of setting your sights too low. I was getting nowhere with her, boy. It was the first high-class woman I ever met, you know. My country stuff wasn't working.
Really?
So I resorted to writing her a song, which was a tactic that I had tried with some success on occasion. And I wrote a song for her and invited her over to my hotel, but I had a piano. And I had flowers on, and I had some champagne there. And I had a seat for two. Got her on that bench, and I thought, she's halfway in the bag. Just kidding, ladies. I do not objectify women. My wife is here. Honey, you're here, right? All right, darling. So, at any rate, after I played the song, I said, what do you think? And she said, I think it's rather silly.
Silly!
I went running back to L.A. I didn't take rejection very well for a songwriter. And on the way home, I see a copy of Rolling Stone, and I see Simon and Garfunkel, Splitsville, and I go, oh, God! And I'm losing my favorite group! And then I'm sitting there for a while. I think the stewardess was very worried about me. She came back and said, is there anything I can do to help Mr. Webb? I said, drop the accent. Yeah, anyway. Anyway. And, I'm sitting there, I'm thinking, yeah, but Paul Simon, he writes all the songs. And Artie Garfunkel, the curly-haired giant, he sings all those beautiful high notes. And so, that equals Artie Garfunkel needs some songs. See, now I'm letting you see the dark side of songwriting. I go up to San Francisco where Artie's sequestered in the studio, listening to song after song after song. And as I walk into the studio, Graham Nash and David Crosby walk out. And they look at me and they say, good luck, pal. And I went, come on, it can't be that hard. You know, I've got 20 and 30 songs. I walk in, I start playing songs for Artie. Well, it was like hitting a stone wall at 120 miles an hour. I'm like halfway through my song and I've got nothing. I mean, it's like, what do you have to do to please this dude anyway, you know? And I say that, we've been close like this for many, many, many years, but I will say it to his face. He's as persnickety and finicky a recording artist as you're ever going to find. And in fact, at one point, he said to me, in all seriousness, he said, just stop for a second. He said, do you have something yellow? I wanted to cut my throat. And then my hands are kind of wandering around the piano because I'm nervous. And then go to this old Baptist hymn, one of the prettiest ones. Na, 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 na. Come thou fount. Right there, Artie. he says, "That's it, I'll have that. I'm going to record that. That's the one I want." And I'm thinking, I still want a Jesus' song. And then I thought, heck, you know what? He's Jewish. And then I thought, no, you can't do that. And the last thing I had, and I had vowed I would never play it again, was a certain song that I like to call the silly song. And I decided to play it. Because it's kind of a Baptist mojo thing. wish I had Artie here to hit that high note tonight. Our relationship has lasted, you know, through several albums, you know, projects, even a cantata that we did, a Christmas cantata we had. I don't know that I came out of here without my reading glasses. No, I've got them. I want to tell you about a project that I have with me tonight. I don't have a lot of merch, but I've got an album, the second volume of an album of collaborations. In fact, it was going to be called Collaborations Volume 1 and 2. And the first one was called Just Across the River. And the one that I have with me tonight is, the newest one is Still Within the Sound of My Voice. And some of the people that I have singing with me on that project are Artie Garfunkel. He came out of, you know, temporary retirement to do that song with me. Keith Urban is on the record. Lyle Lovett. My producer Freddie Mullen and I got the Jordanaires back together. They were all in their 80s. And when I first saw them in the studio, I was terrified. I was alarmed. I wanted to make sure that we had a fibrillator. I should talk. You know, I'm getting there. But I was just worried about what they were going to sound like. And somebody, like, you know, they had a chord, one of those rich Jordanaire chords, and they went, oh, like that, you know? And man, it was the Jordanaires. You know, 80 years had done nothing to their sound. Brian Wilson is with me. Amy Grant, the incomparable Amy Grant. On a little bit of a kind of a bittersweet note, Joe Cocker appears on the album with me. He was one of the most wonderful guys I ever met in this business. I'm talking after meeting thousands of people. Stands out as really one of the sweethearts and was responsible for so much good, so many good deeds that went quietly, modestly, untrumpeted in the media, the way he reached out to the communities he lived in and supported recovery programs, and the image we have of him, you know, at Woodstock, you know, like going completely berserk on stage. That's probably the most enduring image that we will always remember him that way, and that's fine. But there were really two sides to him. And I wanted you to know that he's represented there as well. Doing this song, this is like an oldie, but it goes back to Judy Collins, Joan Baez, Sean Colvin, Linda Ronstadt. Know how well some of my songs did here. But do you guys know worse that could happen?
Yeah.
You do? You do? Johnny Maestro on the Brooklyn Bridge?
Brooklyn Bridge.
You know that, right? Really, or are you just saying that? Because I'm getting ready to sing it, so by God. called Magic Garden, the Fifth Dimension again, recorded The Worst That Could Happen. The great lead singer, I always call him the lead singer, the band would kill me if they heard me say that, because they all, never mind, it was a political situation, but Billy Davis was the guy who did most of the leads, and I felt certain that we had a hit record with The Worst That Could Happen, and was begging the record company to put it out, and while I was begging them and they were stalling and putting out other records that did nothing, it did the album a great disservice, by the way, but you can't always win those arguments. A guy named Wes Farrell, who was Frank Sinatra's son-in-law, who was married to Tina Sinatra, got Johnny Maestro. Johnny Maestro is the most famous probably in the United States for
16 candles make a
lovely. You know, this is in the American DNA. When an American hears that song, they see the back seat of a 63 Impala. Should be converted. Perhaps maybe some other make or model. He was the king of the doo-wop era. He was something. And so Wes gets him and gets these other guys, they call the Brooklyn Bridge, and they go in and they do a copy of our record, which was a tried and true strategy at this point. I'm not being snotty, okay? I'm just... They copied our record almost note for note. And it came out, and while all the record executives were arguing about what to release, worst that could happen went to top 20, like 15, you know, 14, something like that. Couldn't happen to a nicer guy, man. He used to call Laura and I every Christmas and say, "Thanks a lot for the song, Jim. I'm still working it." Girl, I heard you're getting married. I heard you're getting married. This time you're really sure this is the end. They say you really need it. This guy's the one that makes you feel so safe, so sane, and so secure. This is it. I'm showing you. Over here. You guys sing. Cause I'm never, 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 never gonna get married. This is a fade. Cause I'm never, 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 never gonna get married. Quite a few nevers there. It's more like. Cause I'm never, 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 never gonna get married. Listen to this. Do it, okay? You guys take the high part now, all right? This is the best part. 'Cause I'm never, 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 never gonna get married. Go for it. I think the less said about that, the better. Start you guys over here, then I'm going to bring you in. Then I'm going to sing like some Johnny Maestro parts, and we're just going to get into it. Like, this is the big fade, you know? So you had to have a big fade for a hit. Okay? Over here. 'Cause I'm never, 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 never going to get married. Great, keep on.
'Cause I'm never, 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 never going to get married again. 'Cause I'm never, 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 never.
Children, I have six kids. It's like one of their favorite songs. Dad, sing the one about not getting married. Richard Harris said to me one night, we just spent a very trying week on the west coast of Ireland. Looting and pillaging small villages. Looting, pillaging, looting, pillaging. You know, okay, very, very tiresome. And finally we had laid up in the family estate in Kilkee, south of Galway, out on a black cliff that looks like out on the North Atlantic Ocean. There's a kind of an amphitheater there, carved into the black rock. You stand there and you watch these 50-foot waves, 40 and 50-foot waves, just slamming into this cliff, one at a time, all day. And you think about the thousands of years, the hundreds of thousands of years, perhaps millions of years, that those waves have been hit, striking that cliff with such force. And yet it's still there, Ireland, you know. And down there is an amphitheater, all hollowed out with sort of seats around. Nobody sits there because there's 40-foot waves. Every once in a while, you know, the water kind of ebbs, and you can see there's a stage. It's like this thing is unreal, you know. It looks like almost man-made. There's a flat piece of stone down there. It's a passable stage. And I'm standing there with Richard, just musing on this amazing scene. And he said, "Ah, Jubek,
Down there, is he? In that amphitheater. That's where I learned me Shakespeare. Shouting at the waves with my mighty voice, you know.
I looked at him and I thought, yeah, that's a romantic image, shouting at the waves with your mighty voice. And then, like a 70-foot wave comes in, and it fills up the amphitheater completely to the top. It's level. It's like the basin in the bathroom. Suddenly, it's like just full of water, and it's sort of lapping at our feet, and it's kind of like and then it's there for a few seconds, and then it runs away through millions of tiny cracks and little cubby holes and drain pipes, and somehow miraculously the amphitheater reappears. You know, glistening in the afternoon sun. And I look up at Richard, and he says,
"Ah, well, Jimmy, but you know, I was a lot faster then."
He was a little pissed off about it. Actually, the timing was not really good. So he was kind of moping around that afternoon, and I could tell it. And he said,
"Ah, gee, what is it? I have a plan."
And I went, "Oh, no, not another plan. Because plans mean, like, breaking glass, leaving it, going out the back way, you know. Sirens that go like... no plans." And he said,
No, Jimmy Webb. Not that kind of plan. It's another plan. Tonight," he said, "we'll go to Dublin, to the house of me sister. And you'll sleep in the bed where I was conceived."
The excitometer was not exactly topping out on that one. But you know what? I did it. And I don't think it hurt me any. Somewhere in there, while we were goofing around and chasing girls and drinking Guinness, managed to make a record.
like tender babies in your hands. And the old man, all those old men playing checkers.
the park is melting in the dark. All the sweet green I see flowing down. Someone left the cake out in the rain. I don't think that I can take it. It took so long to bake it. I never had the bread. I'll tell you something. Every time I play it, it's different. it's still a moment in my life when I can create. And I don't really feel like I want to do the record. I want to get to the soul of the material and sort of give it to you a little bit differently. So, thank you. There's been a terrible fuss in the last couple of years over Glen Campbell and Glen Campbell's career and his encounter with Alzheimer's, which has been a tragic thing for me, honestly. And I've really tried to stay out of it. I've wanted to support the family as much as possible, help him as much as I could. I never wanted to profit by any of that. I don't know how to put it exactly, but I wouldn't want to be any more famous because Glenn had Alzheimer's. You understand what I'm saying?
Yes.
But it did happen, and I sort of went through this thing where I watched him forgetting my songs. And this is like after 40 years of, you know, just loving this guy like a brother. And he recorded, I think Laura told me, the figure that they finally came up with, because it's insane, but it's worth, I think, mentioning, is that Glenn recorded 167 of my songs. Wow.
because he was just a believer. It was just like, oh, it's got Jimmy Webb on it. Let's go into the studio and cut it. And that's why he's really the first guy who cut Highwaymen. And he's the first person who ever cut The Moon is a Harsh Mistress. And he's the first person who cut a lot of those songs. And it was just belief. It was just belief, raw belief. And I'll always be grateful for that. Because of that little prayer that I said out in the middle of the cornfield that day, no one could have made me believe that what happened was going to happen. It's insane. So I don't compare my loss with the family, but I will tell you that there has been a loss. I think that he's been like heroic as hell. And he went out and did his goodbye tour. He went around the world almost twice. He's walking out on stage with stage 4 Alzheimer's and playing 30, 40 songs, staying up there all night, playing his guitar, singing, using his teleprompter. He wasn't nuts. He knew what was going on. He knew he had a disease. He still got stage fright. He was terrified every night. Imagine how terrified you would be if you had Alzheimer's and you were going out on stage to play in Sydney, at the Sydney Opera House. See, to me, that's guts. That's guts. So he goes out, and he's playing the Sydney Opera House. And all these crazy Australians are there. They've had about 10,000 gallons of Foster's, and God love them, because I'm telling you, they're like almost, except for Mancusians, they're my favorite breed. Rolf Harris, remember Rolf Harris? Uh-oh, did I slip? You got to tell me. Somebody's got to tell me. Oh, he is. Oh, I didn't know that. Well, heaven knows I don't support pedophilia. So anyway, Glenn goes out on stage and plays Tie My Kangaroo Down. No. He plays Wichita Lineman, and it's a beautiful performance, and he hits every lyric, and he plays that not beautiful guitar solo that he invented. And then there's a tremendous uproar, and they're on their feet, and they're yelling and going crazy for him. They love him. He's sort of fiddling with his guitar. Nobody's really paying much attention to him at that exact moment. But he starts the song again. Which is the beautiful intro that Carol Kay wrote, actually, speaking of the Wrecking Crew. He played the little intro, and nobody hardly noticed until they heard him singing it. And the kids, Ashley and Shannon and all the kids, Campbell kids are up there, Cal, and they all fall in with him, and they just start playing it with him. And backstage, there's pandemonium, because they're saying, he's playing it again. What do we get? It's going to be in the newspaper. It's going to be, oh my God, everybody will know that he has Alzheimer's. Like, come on, everybody knows he has Alzheimer's. And he played Wichita Lineman again. And this time he played it even better than the first time. And he got to the end, and there was a quiet, there was a silence, because it could have been an embarrassing moment. It could have been a, who knows what it was one of those pregnant pauses. It was like, what did he just do? Are you allowed to do that? And then in the back, a chant started in the cheap seats. Again, again, again. And they got to their feet, those Australians, and they all shouted together, again, again.
I am a lineman for the county, and I drive the main road. So Jennison, for another on the